Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello and welcome into the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballingy. It's great to have you here with us. You can email the show, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check us out on our website, thegolfnewsnet.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at facebook.com and twitter.com/golfnewsnet. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. If you're a subscriber to this show via the podcast, on iTunes, Stitcher, or the TuneIn Radio app, thank you so much for being a part of that. You can also check out our 24/7 live radio stream called GNN Radio. It's a great mix of terrestrial radio shows, podcasts, raw interviews, and much more. You can find that also in the TuneIn Radio app as well as on golfnewsnet.com/radio. So, as promised, we did a mini podcast last week in the middle of the week, kind of to focus on an article for 15 minutes, but then teased out that we would be spending this time together this week talking about Tiger Woods' debut with Tiger Woods 5.0, that is, in the Hero World Challenge at Isleworth Golf and Country Club. We kind of talked about not having expectations for Woods, not having any understanding of what he had put in with Chris Como. If anything, the work that he had done, how much time he'd been able to commit to it, how much time he'd been able to commit to a short game, or any of those kinds of things, especially with his girlfriend, Lindsey Vonn, returning to competition in the World Cup simultaneously in Alberta, Canada, that same weekend, which she won, which was great for her to come back after basically 2 years away from competitive skiing. But for Woods, the story wasn't the same. He finished tied for 17th, along with buddy Hunter Mahan, former Sean Foley stablemate, in basically last place for the field. Actually, it's not basically. He was last place in the field. And for most of the week, he was in last place by himself, primarily because he shot 5 over 77 to open the tournament at his former home course. And I think the immediate reaction, if you're watching on Twitter, and I do watch on Twitter or tend to, is, especially during the weekday rounds, is if you're watching on Twitter and you react shot by shot, then you think in a shot by shot mindset. And that's nothing wrong with that because it can be really entertaining. But the problem is that you don't see a tournament for what it is. You don't see a guy for who he is or where he's at in his career, his development, etc. And you could tell, I think, pretty easily that Woods was nervous on the first tee shot. And really, he was nervous for the first 9 holes on Thursday at Isleworth. The first tee shot, it's a snap hook left out of bounds. You could see in kind of the development of his swing and the number of YouTubes and Vines that were out there of his swing leading into the tournament over the first couple of days, you know, the preview days, the pro-am day. You could see he was really struggling with a closed face at the top of his swing. So obviously the natural result is if you take that too far, you're going to shut the face at impact and you're going to go left. And that's what happened with that opening tee shot. And then you kind of set yourself up for the overcorrection, which is to blast it to the right, which happened a couple times in the opening round, because you realize your face is closed at the top, so you try to kind of lag back a little bit and you create a push. So you saw that right away. You saw that was going to be the problem, is you could face a duck hook, and if you overcorrect, you're going to go to the right. Which I mean, if you have an open face at the top, you could overcorrect, snap it over the top, and hook it left. So there's pretty much any way to go wrong with golf swing. But overall, the mechanics looked great on day one, but what was clear from the very beginning, really, was that Woods had a terrible short game, and that was going to be the thing he had to work on in the off season. And over the course of the week, as his rounds progressed, he improved, and then really improved each day, the first 3 days, and then fired a 72 to close, which really, he was in a position to shoot 69 in the final day, but I think doubled the last hole, and that would have easily kept him out of a tie for last and would have put Hunter Mahan in last to himself, but there you have it. But I digress. The problem with Woods was clearly a short game. 9 chunks over the course of a week. That number, I do not think, includes a scald chip shot, nor does it include a bunker shot that was left in a bunker on day one. It's brutal. It was really hard to watch. I mean, at times, let's put it this way. For the week, Woods hit about 68% of the greens in regulation. So over the course of his 72-hole tournament, he missed 30-ish percent. So that's about 21 to 22 greens for the tournament. He chunked between 9 and 11, you know, mishandled 9 to 11 shots around the greens, which means he screwed up about half the time. When you think about that, and there was the double chunk on 13, when you think about that, that's really staggering, because that does not happen to professional golfers. They screw up. They screw up all the time. You just don't see it on camera. You see it if you watch it in person, because they only show shots that are especially good or especially bad, or the leaders on TV. But these guys make mistakes. Otherwise, everyone would get up and down all the time. But for a professional, a former number one of the world, a 14-time major champion, a guy who was so lethal inside of 100 yards and around the greens as Tiger Woods was, even as far back as 5 years ago, it's kind of staggering. And you could see the frustration. You could see the embarrassment on his face. He knew what he was doing wasn't working, but he just didn't have the answer to fix it in competition. And I think part of that is not having ownership over your technique, because he was transitioning from adapting his short game technique to his full swing technique under Sean Foley. Now he's trying to do the same thing again with this new old new swing. And I don't see the wisdom in that. I really don't. And I think a lot of people are dumbfounded that he made that decision with Foley and is going to continue it with under his own guidance and Chris Como's watchful eye. Because they are somewhat similar, but they're really not. There are very distinct differences in my mind between what makes a good chip and what makes a good swing. There are certain mechanics that are absolutely the same, but there are some that are definitely not. And so I don't understand Woods' drive to kind of make those motions exactly the same, particularly because he doesn't swing exactly the same with his driver as he does with his irons. Because if you look at the TrackMan data for every player, kind of average together and create a prototypical PGA Tour player, the prototypical PGA Tour player hits down on or kind of de-lofts the golf club with every club in the bag with a full swing except driver. They hit up because you only have so much loft and you want to create additional loft, because really the ideal launch is a 14-degree launch and you get a more carry out of it. We could talk about what the ideal launch number is if you're a TaylorMade, but regardless, you swing up. So you make a different swing, a different motion with the driver than you do with your irons, which means it's okay to make a different motion with a wedge in your hand or some kind of chip shot than with a full swing with an iron. You don't swing the same way with the putter as you do with an iron. The acceleration is all different. The release is all different. So again, I disagree with Tiger entirely on this notion, and I really hope that he goes back and looks at more footage of the way he used to chip and the way he used to pitch. Really, it's inside of 75 yards that was killing him. And if he can figure that out, there was a lot to like about the way that he played. He had about 70% of the fairways, about 70% of the greens. Isleworth is not an easy course by any stretch of the imagination. It is actually a really difficult golf course. Even though it's a par 72, you could stretch out the slope, the rating to, I think it was 78 set on television. I know for certain it's over 76, which means if you posted around underneath 76, you beat what you'd expect for the terrain. And so we did that three rounds, which is pretty good. But then again, he shot 59 there once, so not so good. But I think you have to walk away feeling pretty good if you're a Tiger Woods fan. If you hate Tiger Woods, which seems like a lot of people who read my Yahoo articles do, then you're going to be in total dismay if Tiger plays well in 2015, because he's going to be in the news. We're going to talk about him a lot in the media. We're going to wonder if he can win 15, and if he does, can he win 16, 17, 18, and 19? And that talk will be revived the second he wins a major championship. If he gets into contention in major championships, we'll talk about him. If he doesn't close the deal, we'll talk about him. And part of that is because you listen. You read. And I don't mean you, the podcaster, podcast listener. But the general public pays attention to Tiger Woods. Golf really pays attention to Tiger Woods. And there are some people who are legitimately disinterested in whatever Woods has to say. For whatever reason. They don't like the guy personally. They don't like what he did to his wife. Whatever. But most people are interested in him. They want to know what he's going to do. And for someone like Stephen A. Smith, who I can't believe I'm going to acknowledge this guy on a podcast, but kind of went out of his way on his program on ESPN2, First Take, don't ever watch it. I watch it for white noise sometimes. He kind of derailed Woods as he's finished. He's never looked worse, yada, yada, yada. I would argue he looked worse in 2010 when he came back from the unfortunateness of his serial philandering of his wife. So, and even Hank Haney talked about it in trying to rebuild Woods' swing in time for a competitive comeback for the Masters. Haney was worried Woods wouldn't even break 80, and he actually was a contender. So that gives you a sense of how bad it was to how okay it got. And I think this is better, where he's at right now. And he's really not that far away. And I know that sounds kind of strange to say for a guy who mishandled double-digit short game shots, but if you figure that out, you're in good shape. It's fine. So I think you can't pencil Woods in for anything for 15. We don't even know where he's going to start the year yet. He hasn't announced that. We know he's not going to play in the Middle East because they're not willing to pay him $3 million to show up anymore. He's not going to start his season at the Indian Open because although it is back on the schedule and sponsored by his new sponsor, Hero Motors, he didn't even know the dates of the tournament when he was asked about it. So there's a good chance that with that kind of candor and the reaction that he's not going to play this year, but might in 2016. So all signs kind of point to Torrey Pines to start the year. But if he's not going to play in the Middle East, he's not going to make that trek overseas, then there's a decent chance he could play another event on the West Coast on the PGA Tour, which could mean Phoenix, it could mean LA, it could mean Pebble Beach. I think between those three, I would probably expect him to play Phoenix because he doesn't forget slights. AT&T was his sponsor on his bag and of his tournament, although they were locked into a long-term contract, before they backed out of sponsoring Woods' bag when everything came out in Thanksgiving 2009, and then subsequently he lost a whole boatload of sponsors and a boatload of money. So I don't know that he's going to come back and play, but he could kind of swallow that again. He's done it before and play this tournament at Pebble Beach. I think it would be really good for the event, which has kind of languished. Not that it's a bad event. It's a cool week, but it just kind of languishes a little bit. Phoenix is fine regardless of who plays. It doesn't matter. There's going to be 500,000 people who show up over the course of the week. A lot of them college students. Most of them get drunk. And the golf is kind of secondary for anyone who's not in the field. So that tournament's fine. And L.A., I don't think he's a big fan of Riviera. In fact, I'm very certain of it. And I don't think that he necessarily likes the folks who are kind of behind Riviera and run the tournament. But we'll see. We'll get a sense of that very soon. He doesn't have to tell us now. It'll be a nice, pleasant surprise when we find out where he goes to play. But expectations for the rest of the year, I don't know that you can really have any. Because he said he's going to work basically this week. He's going to put his clubs away for the holidays. And then he's going to bust them back out sometime in January. So he's going to take the next few weeks off, which he should do. It's the holidays, and he's worth $1 billion, so he's got the time to do that. And he's going to spend time with his kids. He's going to spend time with Lindsey Vonn. He's going to spend time with his ex, Ilan Nordegren. And they'll have nice holidays together, and then he'll decide to commit back to the game. What I'll be very interested to see is moving forward. We saw Chris Como on the range this past week at Isleworth. Will he be a steady presence there? Will he be a virtual presence? Will Woods have someone filming his swing, kind of sending it back to him via email or V1 or whatever app he wants to use for swing analysis? He may do that. He may just be looking at it himself and then call Chris Como in for advice as he needs him, either physically or virtually. That'll be really interesting to see as that unfolds. Obviously, I think Como will be there for the big tournaments, the major championships. That makes all the sense in the world, especially if you're trying to as Woods is, win the major, and you feel like you may need to make an adjustment after a round of the tournament to kind of get everything in line and play your best golf. So I think we'll see him at those. And then you kind of look toward the major venues for 2015. Obviously, Augusta National is a place he likes. He doesn't seem to screw up there. You have Chambers Bay, which is a complete unknown for the U.S. Open. It'll be more of a link-style course, so I think in that sense, Woods may actually find it really intriguing, engaging mentally, and good for his game because he'll be able to get away, if the conditions are firm and fast, as I expect Mike Davis to pursue them in Washington State, then he's going to be able to play an open championship-style golf, which he really likes. Gives him a chance to work the ball high and low, left and right. It gives him an advantage over so many players who just don't have those shots in the bag, at least with the degree of confidence that he probably will have by the time June rolls around. And I think that gives him somewhat of an advantage, but of course, we don't know the green complexes very well. Neither does the field. We don't really know the runoff areas, so we'll just have to see how that plays out. And then there's St. Andrews, which is back every fifth year in the rotation. Woods obviously has success there, winning in 05 and 2000. Didn't win in 2010. That went to Louis Oosthuizen by a million. And in 2015, I think he's got a good chance to contend. But of course, all weather dependent and draw dependent. So, and then you have Whistling Straits to end the year for the PGA Championship, which did not go very well for Tiger in 2010. But then again, that was the place where he decided to start working with Sean Foley. So that was almost a lost tournament. I think he finished T37 that week, something like that. He can play there. He can definitely play there. It's not that crazy of a golf course. And he's won on Pete Dye tracks before. He won the Players a couple years ago. So I don't think it's completely out of the question for him to contend in those places. Do I expect him to win any of those? No. But I think we'll get a better sense of whether or not we should consider him a favorite in any major championship in 2015 based on what we see on those West Coast starts that we'll get in the new year. Let's shift gears a little bit to the guy who actually won the damn thing, which is Jordan Spieth. And if you're not on the Jordan Spieth bandwagon or you have not bought into Jordan Spieth stock, what the hell is wrong with you? This guy at 21 and still has several months at 21 is going to play some incredible golf next year. In back-to-back tournaments, Spieth has managed to shoot a 63 in conditions where at the Aussie Open, where he won in Sydney at the Australian, where there Rory McIlroy put it very well, given 100 rounds in those conditions, he's not even certain he would be able to produce that 63 that Spieth shot to win the tournament by 6 shots. He became the first American in 21 years to win the Australian Open, and he did it in a way that showed what he is capable of when he plays his best golf. Then he flies 9,000 miles to Orlando. He plays against an 18-man field on a very difficult golf course that a lot of these guys made look really easy. And he blows it up. Shoots another 63 in there. Closes with 66. Gets 26 under par. 262. He wins by 10. 10! 10! That's unbelievable. The guy's won his last two starts by a combined 16 shots. I mean, that is dominant golf. And I understand this time of year, a lot of guys are tired. A lot of guys aren't quite as motivated. But at least in the Australian Open, a lot of guys were motivated because they're Aussies and they want to win their national championship. And in this tournament, not so much. But a lot of these guys are familiar with this track from either Tavistock Cup or being members or living in Orlando or what have you. So and Spieth won a collegiate tournament here by 8 shots in one of his two seasons at Texas. I think he won 3 times while he was there in individual events, and this was one of them. So he obviously had a familiarity with the course, like the course, but to just blow away a world-class field like that, even if it's a short field, it's pretty remarkable. You look at the guys that he has beaten that were in those two fields. There was some overlap, but not much. He beat basically the entire top 10 in the world plus Tiger Woods in the last 2 weeks and made them look way behind his talent level. Now, obviously, season ends here. There's potential to lose form, and all the momentum that he has going into 2015 that he sounds like he has right now could go away over the holidays and getting ready for the new year and all that stuff. That could certainly happen. But I think these two wins not so much do things for his form, because it's pretty flawless as it was. But what it does for him mentally, I think, is the biggest boost that he's going to get out of this. Because, and he mentioned it when he won the Aussie Open, he said that for him to accomplish winning the Australian Open is going to take so much more than that for him to win a major championship. And this comes from a guy who had the lead on the front nine on Sunday at the Masters. So he knows what it takes to hold the lead in a major championship. He knows what it takes to hold the lead on the final day of a major championship. And he still believes that what he has showed to this point will take tons more to close the deal. I don't know that I believe that entirely. Part of that might be just self-motivation. But if that's where he believes he's at, then the win goes a long way in Australia to kind of boosting his confidence, because he beat guys like Rory McIlroy and Adam Scott, who was playing okay. McIlroy, who played okay the first half and then not so good in the second half of the tournament. And then he goes 9,000 miles and knows his game can travel between continents, if not halfway around the world, to be able to beat another elite field and make it look like child's play. Make it look like he was playing mini golf. That's how easy it was out there for him. That's got to give him a ton of confidence and belief that no matter who's in the field, no matter where he's playing, if his game is in good shape, he'll figure out a way to at least contend, if not win the thing. So he's got 3 professional wins before the age of 21. That's better than Rory McIlroy had. I think that goes a long way in kind of giving him the confidence that he can win a major at 22. There's the sky's the limit for Jordan Spieth. And I think people slept on him this year because he didn't win a tournament. He didn't follow up in the sophomore season to the win that he had the John Deere Classic. But he was so consistent routinely on the leaderboard. You have to like that about Spieth. You have to like his moxie. You have to like that he's so driven to be able to perform consistently. He doesn't strike me as a guy, and we talked about this about Rory McIlroy. Rory McIlroy playing his best golf, he's practically unbeatable, even against the best golf of his peers. He's just that good. I think you can throw an asterisk in there for Spieth, what we saw the last couple of weeks. But when Rory McIlroy isn't playing very well, and he just doesn't have the best game, he kind of just tends to go along. And we saw that at the Australian Open of the weekend. He didn't look all that engaged, and after his third round, I can't exactly blame him for not looking all that interested. But he just kind of withdraws. So he doesn't always have the ability to turn what starts out or what becomes a not-so-great tournament into one where it could actually be thrilling and give the leaders a scare. So Spieth does that. I mean, he seems to have that grinder's mentality with the talent of a guy who could be number one in the world someday. He's now in the top 10 of the world. He's number 9 in the world. It's not going to be that far away for him being in the top 5 in the world. And I just see a lot of big things for Spieth in 15. Obviously, it's clouded by 2 weeks, but you have to believe, or you had to have believed, even before this, that Spieth was going to figure out how to win again and win in bunches. And I don't think Spieth is streaky like McIlroy is. I think Spieth is consistent, a guy who could win with B, maybe even C stuff. And that's going to make him a really interesting foil for Rory McIlroy these next few years, if he maintains this level of ability. You have Ricky Fowler, who found a way to be incredibly consistent in the majors, the first guy to finish top 5 in all 4 in one season and not actually win one of them, which is pretty remarkable. So the thing I'm really excited about is having, and this was tweeted out by Jamie Kennedy, who runs the European Tour social media and does a brilliant job of it. But this week kind of marks a true changing of the guard, at least as far as the official World Golf Ranking recognizes it. You have Rory at number 1, you have Spieth in the top 10, you got Fowler and Day basically there. That's awesome. Those are guys in their 20s. That means almost half of the top 10 in the world are guys in their 20s. That's the changing of the guard. That's where this is the moment where it happens. We close the year and go, next year is the year of guys in their 20s. Obviously, if you look at the guys who won the majors this year, you have Bubba Watson, who's in his mid-30s. You have Martin Keimer, who is barely into his 30s at this point. And then you have Rory McIlroy, who's in his early 20s. You want to call it mid-20s, whatever. But early 20s. So really interesting to see how it got younger. The feel of the year got younger as we went along. I really do feel that way. And you kind of see it, obviously, heading into the off season. Be interesting to see how 15 unfolds. I'm super excited for 2015. I think it's going to be one of the most exciting years of golf we've had in quite a while. And 14 was great because of what Rory McIlroy produced at the very tail end of it. What he did in the majors, peeling off three in a row, including two majors in the World Golf Championships event, was awesome. You just have to love what he accomplished. And I think for Whit Spieth to do it against top-notch competition in back-to-back events to close the season. They may not be PGA Tour wins, but they are big wins in his mind. They're big wins for next year. And I can't wait. We're going to do one more podcast this year. We're going to kind of wrap everything up next week heading into Christmas. Then we'll take a couple of weeks off. We'll come back at the start of the year. We'll resume our podcast and resume the golf season as the PGA Tour will kick back up with the Hyundai Tournament of Champions out in Hawaii. We'll kind of get a sense of the type of feel we're going to get for that event. Obviously, it's a winners-only invitation, but we'll just have to see how this all plays out in terms of participation over the first couple months of the season with top players. Obviously, with the schedule so backloaded these days, it'll be interesting to find out what guys want to commit to earlier tournaments and what guys just want to wait a few months before basically teeing it up in the Florida swing, getting their season started. Until next week, I'm Ryan Balaji's thing. Thanks so much for listening to the 19th Hole Golf Show. Thanks so much for your support, and we'll talk to you next week.